interests, and he was our producer for every Python movie from then on. Filming Grail was uncomfortable, to say the least. We began shooting in Scotland near Glencoe in May, and it was cold and damp and miserable. One of our two cameras broke on the very first shot, while Graham clung to a ledge, shaking with nerves. We thought he was supposed to be a mountaineer. We didn't know he was an alcoholic. The shaking was not nerves, but DTs, and someone quickly snuck him up a bottle of gin. Both Graham and John refused to run across the rope bridge that spans the gorge of eternal peril. To be fair, the Bridge of Death was terrifying. It was erected across a deep gorge by Everest mountaineer Hamish McInnes and his local mountain rescue crew. I, for one, certainly would never have crossed it. But fortunately, my character Robin was killed before I had to. Since we were all wearing woolen armour, jogging across the wet heather, pretending to ride horses, you could tell what time of day it was by how far up your legs the damp had climbed. At the end of each day, we had to change out of our soggy tights, so by the time we got to the hotel we shared with the crew, all the hot water was gone. John and I soon had enough of this and found a nearby hotel, a hydro, with plenty of hot water. And amazingly, just as we moved in, 24 beautiful young damsels arrived for their scenes as the maidens bathing in Castle Anthrax. We didn't tell the others. Grail wasn't fun. Terry J directed the comedy scenes and made sure the jokes were on screen, while Terry G shot the art scenes like the dragon boat and the more mystical shots of castles, which made it look like a real movie. Since both Terrys played multiple roles in the film, it must have been exhausting for them. We were completely unsympathetic and would complain endlessly and badger them to get on with it. Terry Gilliam came in for a lot of this abuse because when we'd done a perfect take, he would call for one more. "What was wrong with that?" John would inquire testily. "Not enough smoke," he would reply, to John's disgruntlement. The smoke became quite an issue, and eventually Graham would quantify it from 1 gilliam, which was light mist, to 10 gilliams, which was smoke so thick no one could see the actors. Of course, it's his genius art direction that gives the film its unexpectedly fine cinematic quality, just as it was Terry Jones's comic brilliance that ensured we shot several really funny scenes in one take. That meant no one could interfere with our timing by inserting close-ups or pauses or reaction shots. The guard scene is the best example. It's all up there on the screen, one long shot. You can see all three of us clearly, including our legs. Feet are funny, and we played it in real time like a scene from the theatre. "Not to leave the room till you or anybody else, not anybody else, you..." The timing of Graham's hiccups is just wonderful. This was the scene we had the most trouble with in Spamalot and often cut it all together. At its first public screening in a cinema in West London, Monty Python and the Holy Grail was a total disaster. It tanked big time. This is where the Python Writers' Committee really came into its own. We commandeered a room and set to work discussing where it went wrong. The two exhausted Terrys, who had been cutting different versions, could only listen and be grateful for the help. Neil Innes's medieval soundtrack was the first thing to go. It wasn't bad in itself, but it killed the comedy stone dead. When it was replaced by cliché music from a film library, the comedy began to come alive. It didn't need sackbuts and tabers, it needed swashbuckling Hollywood movie music. Now it was parody. You knew where you were. We made cuts and changes in the text, too, added voiceovers to clarify the story, and did some small reshoots like a claw turning over the book of the film. A prop I oddly came across last February at the Pasadena Antiquarian Book Fair. They wanted $50,000 for it. I didn't buy it, but I did sign it and verified it as the genuine article. It took 13 test screenings of the Holy Grail, dragging the scenes to where the audience laughed, before we were satisfied. It was worth it. The Holy Grail opened to a perfect storm in New York in April 1975. Ron DeVilliers at Dallas PBS had bought a very cheap show the BBC were practically giving away. And when he put Flying Circus on late night on Sundays, he was rewarded by amazing figures. Other PBS stations followed suit, and soon New York began to play it too. We were a cult hit. When we opened the Holy Grail at Cinema 2 in New York, Don Rugoff advertised it by paying a knight to go up and down Fifth Avenue pretending to ride a horse, followed by a squire clopping coconuts. In a newspaper ad, he promised free coconuts to the first 1,000 people to attend the opening screening at 11 a.m. We were woken at 9 and told to get over to the cinema pronto, as there were lines round the block. It was something like Beatlemania. For safety reasons, the NYPD were insisting they put on an earlier screening. We arrived to huge cheers and were then trapped in the cinema all day, emerging at the end of each showing to sign coconuts. I don't know if you've ever tried signing a coconut, and why would you, but it's not easy. Plus, the crowd was so big, they had to send out for more coconuts. To keep us company in the long gaps between emerging audiences, two of our investors, Jimmy Page and Robert Plant, very kindly came by and hung out with us. We'd never met them before, and they were modest and sweet, and of course the fans couldn't believe they were there. I'm happy to think they still get money from Spamalot. The next morning, we co-hosted AM America live on TV, and then were taken off to be photographed by Richard Avedon for Vogue magazine. In the limo, we discussed what we might do.
"Well, we certainly won't be naked," said someone.
That did it. Of course, we had to be naked. It was a classic Python photo, and we spent a very silly session with the enchanting Avedon, with us all completely in the buff. A photo marred only by the absence of John. When I later reproduced the photo in the Monty Python scrapbook, I got Basil Powell to insert a photo of John on set in Tunisia in just his wife fronts. In the magazine article, Leo Lerman, the veteran Vogue writer, said we were like slightly cracked angels. On our way out of the studio, we glanced down at Avedon's typewriter, where he'd just started a letter. "Dear Princess Margaret," it began. We couldn't have been happier, leaving in a squeal of giggles, off to the Bronx Zoo to christen a python Monty. I avoided the beast like the plague. The opening party was held at Relaxation Plus, a massage parlour in the basement of the Commodore Hotel on Fifth Avenue. No, I don't know why. Each of the rooms had a different theme, for example, naval flags. There was a large central jacuzzi into which a naked Terry Jones was soon inviting guests. He's friendly that way. I was chased around a massage table by a very tall actress from Lil Abner, called Julie Newmar, who seemed determined on something, but I managed to escape intact. Andy Warhol was there, Jeff Beck was there, Dick Cavett was there. It was odd. We were a thing. That May, we screened The Holy Grail out of competition at the Cannes Film Festival. We had thoughtfully taken along Jeanette Charles, a Queen Elizabeth lookalike, to change the name of a street from the Rue Python to the Rue Monty Python. At our screening that evening, soon after the movie began, local firemen in brass helmets raced in and evacuated the cinema. The audience thought this was part of the joke and stood happily in the streets while the pompiers searched the auditorium. It was a hoax, but the audience laughed even harder at the movie when they went back in. I now had my own TV series on BBC Two. Rutland Weekend Television began taping in January 1975, and our first six shows aired from May through June. I bought the title from John for £1. Rutland was the smallest county in England, over 1,000 years old, and the new Conservative government had just ruled it out of business, stating it was now part of Leicestershire. If you really want to fuck with the English, then history is a good place to start. Rutland was outraged. As soon as the Leicestershire Council took down their signs, they would replace them with their own new ones. I liked the idea of having a tiny television station that broadcast from a place that had just been unmade. Sure, it broadcast only once a week, but it had plays like Three Men on a Goat, its own rock band with an all-dead singer, light entertainment shows, and sports. International wife-swapping from Redcar. It was a good model for TV satire, and I had a lot of fun writing and creating sketches for it. RWT was shot on a shoestring in a tiny studio next to the weather studio on the fourth floor at the BBC Television Centre. Even the shoestring was borrowed. I had a great cast of funny people, and Neil Innes contributed songs, which he would send to me, and I would turn into sketches or movie ideas. Not many people saw it. Because it had no live audience, I was never very sure whether it was funny or not, and some people kindly went out of their way to point out that it wasn't. That summer, we were all working separately, John on Fawlty Towers, Michael and Terry J on Tompkinson School Days, and me on Rutland. Still, we had a movie to open. Sometime in August 1975, Terry Gilliam and I flew out to L.A. to do promo for the opening of the Holy Grail in Westwood. It was stinking hot, and we were driven everywhere in a little old beater with no air conditioning. The movie had yet to open in L.A. Our TV show wasn't yet on PBS in California. We were so unknown that Gilliam and I joined the line for the first screening of The Holy Grail outside a cinema in Brentwood, listening to the fans chattering away about Python. They were fanatics, but only from our albums. One afternoon, I was invited to a house in Laurel Canyon for a swim. When I arrived, it turned out I was the only guest. The young lady who had invited me was wearing a tiny bikini and proposing we relax and take mescaline. The afternoon was filled with exotic promise when I got an urgent phone call from Terry Gilliam.
Eric, can you come and get me?
What?
Just come and get me, please.
Where are you?
I'm in the back of Book Soup on Sunset.
What's up? Just please, come and get me.
He sounded desperate. I did the British thing. I apologized to the young lady and assured her I'd be right back. But I must leave immediately on an errand of mercy. Racing down to Book Soup, I found Terry cowering in the back of the store. He seemed to have lost it.
It's all out there. Everything. Hollywood. Movies. It's all out there.
I understood all was not well in the Gilliam cranium. I know Terry suffers from dark moods. It goes with his genius. I think that having grown up in the San Fernando Valley and maybe dreaming one day of directing, he was now back, having directed his first movie, and it had all become too much for him. I think all the Pythons are nuts in some way, and together we make one completely insane person. I took him to tea, and he soon calmed up. My afternoon was in any case ruined. That evening, my life changed anyway, for at the screening of The Holy Grail at the old Directors Guild on Sunset, I met George Harrison. I had heard that George wanted to meet me, but I was somewhat shy of meeting him. People said he was an enormous fan of Python and a big fan of me personally because I'd written a sketch for Flying Circus about an actor being busted by the police. The policeman had thoughtfully brought a package of his own. When the actor opened the brown paper bag, he found sandwiches.
"Sandwiches?" says the policeman. "Blimey, whatever did I give the wife for lunch?"
Cut to a stoned wife.
"I don't know, baby, but it was better than sandwiches."
This was the only line cut by the BBC from the first series. George had assumed, probably rightly, that the sketch was based on his own drug bust in Esher, where the police had brought their own cannabis, and was anxious to meet me. I was shy and tried to avoid him, but he snuck up on me in the back of the theatre as the credits began to roll. I hadn't yet learned he was unstoppable. We began a conversation that would last about 24 hours. Who could resist his opening line?
"We can't talk here. Let's go and have a reefer in the projection booth."
No telling what the startled projectionist felt as a beetle came in with one of the actors from the movie he'd just projected and lit up a joint. He managed eventually to get us to leave, and we went off for dinner with Terry Gilliam and Olivia Harrison. After dinner, George insisted I go with him to A&M Studios, where he introduced me to Joni Mitchell. Joni fucking Mitchell, for Christ's sake! Saxophonist Tom Scott was at work on some overdubs of George's latest album, Extra Texture, and we listened to some of the tracks and then went back to the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, where we talked and talked and talked for the rest of the night. What was it like to be a Python? What was it like to be a Beatle? What was John like? What was your John like? A thousand questions. Did you really smoke a reefer in the Buckingham Palace toilets? It might have been a cigarette, but it felt so naughty even doing that there that it felt like we smoked a joint, he replied honestly. Funny and serious and wise, he changed my life. We played together, partied together, argued together. He was irresistible. It was definitely love at first sight. Back in England, my marriage was drawing to its sad conclusion. But shortly after I returned, in early September 1975, George and Olivia invited me to visit Friar Park, their palatial home in Henley-on-Thames. I drove up for dinner with Lynn and little Carrie in our VW. We came across a huge gate with an exquisite gnome's cottage behind it, with twisted chimneys. It was incredible. "This is beautiful," I said, ringing the bell.
"Oh, this is just the gate cottage," they replied. "The house is further up."
We drove up a long, winding drive between huge dripping trees, through banks of rhododendrons, past manicured gardens, and there, ahead of us, under a magnificent cedar tree, was the most amazing Victorian neo-Gothic mansion. It was bigger than my boarding school. Friar Park was built in 1889 by the eccentric lawyer Sir Frank Crisp. It is a dream of a palace, with William Morris tiles, polished wood interiors, a huge carved fireplace, and elaborate dining rooms, bedrooms, and drawing rooms. It features caves, grottos, underground passages, and all kinds of formal gardens and lakes. Carved stone friars' heads popped out of walls with philosophical quotes, many of which were already lyrics of George's, as some of which would soon become them. "Scan not a friend with microscopic glass. You know his faults. Now let the foibles pass. Life is one long enigma, my friend. So read on, the answer's at the end." On the grounds was a huge-scale model of the Matterhorn, covered in snow, scattered with edelweiss and alpine trees, under which ice caves led magically back into the house. Large signs instructed you to stay on the grass. Beyond the lawn with its Shiva fountain lay underlapping lakes and underwater caves with a little electric boat to take you through twisting tunnels behind the waterfalls into a magnificent blue grotto, from which you emerged into a Japanese garden with an exquisite tea house perched over a high waterfall. It is still the most unique and incredible house I have ever seen. Following the disaster of what he called the Dark Horse Tour, George had retreated from the world into gardening. He was obsessive, but he did not neglect his music, for upstairs was a beautifully carved, fully equipped recording studio, with every single Beatles guitar from every era hanging on the wall. After dinner, Lynn took Carrie home, and I stayed on for days, spending hours listening to the tracks he had racked up, playing guitars and eating Kumar's curries, talking, sharing, laughing, emerging onto the lawn at dawn to play frisbee. George made me welcome, cheered me up, and played his two jukeboxes like a professional, to instruct and delight. Of course he had some Monty Python, but they were heavy with Dylan. I was swept up into a magical world, complete with his friends, for you had to meet everyone, the extraordinary Derek Taylor, local musician friends, Andy Fairweather Lowe, John Lord and Deep Purple, Joe Brown and Alvin Lee. It was like entering Wonderland. And always there was his running commentary, for I soon learned the quiet one never stopped talking. He spoke about everything and everyone and was never shy to voice an opinion. The only thing we never agreed on was religion, but we agreed to disagree, for it was so much a part of his being, this ex-Catholic who had embraced Hinduism, sought enlightenment in Rishikesh, learned to play sitar, and single-handedly influenced the culture of the world by introducing Ravi Shankar and Indian art, music, and literature into 60s Britain. All this from a guitarist in a rock group. Of course they were the Beatles, but imagine all that influence stemming from the enthusiasm of a single scouse, and you get the glimpse of the determination of George. Extra Texture was released in September 1975. He immediately put me to work recording radio ads for this new album, subtitled Oh, Not Him Again, and even had me add a couple of Pepperpot lines on his single This Song, which was a riposte to the lawsuit he was fighting with the aid of his manager, Dennis O'Brien. In exchange for my help, he agreed to star in my Rutland Weekend Television Christmas special, which aired on BBC Two on Boxing Day, December the 26th, 1975, singing a song we had written together. George lurched on as a truculent and slightly unstable pirate and demanded to know where the pirate sketch was. As the sleazy compere, I insisted he was only there to sing My Sweet Lord, and there was no pirate sketch. But he was having none of that. No pirate sketch. Well, up you then. And off he stormed. Finally, at the end of the show, the set lit up saying, George Harrison sings, and he came down the stairs, dressed all in white, playing the familiar opening chords of My Sweet Lord on his 12-string. Just as he finished the intro, he beamed and suddenly switched into the pirate song which we'd written together. I'd like to be a pirate's life for me. All my friends are pirates and sail to BBC. I've got a Jolly Roger, it's black and white and vast, so get out of your skull and crossbones, I'll ram it up your mast. It was a terrific gag and still one of my favourite moments. It is the only Harrison Idol song, but certainly up there with the best of Lennon and McCartney. Olivia told me she thought it was the bravest thing George ever did. Afterwards, we celebrated for hours, and here is his amazing luck. On his way home to Henley, at 4 in the morning, his car ran out of gas, and he slid onto the forecourt of a country pub, whose landlord he cheerfully woke up to begin serving drinks. Chapter 10, The Divorce Fairy. By Christmas 1975, the divorce fairy was hovering. My marriage was breaking up, and no wonder. Lynn was a lovely woman and a good mother, and she certainly deserved better. Not surprisingly, my faithlessness was rewarded by hers, and she left me and my 2-year-old son in London to spend Christmas in France. I did learn that infidelity is not a good basis for a marriage. Best to disappoint one woman at a time. Sad, but with my lovely blonde son for company, I got an unexpected boost. On a snowy Christmas Eve, 2 men delivered an enormous thing wrapped in brown paper from a lorry. We ripped the paper off to find a fully stacked jukebox filled with all George's favourite records. A note said, "Every home should have one. Happy Christmas. Love, George and Olivia." That Christmas, Carrie and I danced away. He could only just reach the buttons. He could punch 1, 2, 3, which was Money by Pink Floyd, but his favourite was Bohemian Rhapsody. He adored that song. When I finally moved out of our house in St. John's Wood to a cold flat in Pimlico, Lynn did an amazing thing. She promised me she would never come between me and my son. I always thought that was really mature, and I've always been grateful to her for that. Now I was miserable and alone, and served me right. I'd been an asshole. Men come in 3 sizes, small, medium, and extremely fucked up. I know men aren't entirely alone in this. A female friend told me she was looking for a boyfriend. "What sort of man are you looking for?" I asked. "Well," she said, "he must be breathing and have a penis." My post-marital depression began to lift in January 1976, when I was offered 3 TV commercials in Australia for a Nudge chocolate bar. From cold winter London, I was flown first class to Sydney, where it was summer, with sun, sea, sand, cricket, and that extraordinary harbour with its bridge, its exciting opera house, and across the bay, artist Martin Sharp's beckoning mad clown head at Luna Park. I went to Bondi, where I ventured into the sea and experienced the first joys of Australian surf, which was like being popped into a washing machine and turned upside down underwater. I emerged eventually onto the beach with a mouthful of sand and with as much dignity as I could muster. Pommies. Before I left London, Richard Neville, one of the editors of Oz magazine, who was arrested and tried for a controversial school kids edition, had given me a pile of postcards introducing me to the most interesting people in Sydney. "This pallid masturbating wreck standing in front of you is called Eric Idle. Please look after him." I think on the first night at a party, I met them all. A Australians are amazingly kind people, and they invited me to everything, including a trip to the Blue Mountains, where I spent a weekend with little Nell Campbell, long before Rocky Horror, the exquisite Gail Mackay and her boyfriend Stephen McLean, and the English photographer Tim Street Porter. We drank exotic cocktails and stayed at the Carrington, a delightful old hotel in Katoomba. In Melbourne, I shot my Nudge commercials next to the Melbourne Cricket Ground, where Australia was engaged in a titanic struggle with Clive Lloyd's West Indies cricket team, and then returned to Sydney for some more relaxation. Before I'd left for Australia, George sent me a gift. He'd been giving me spiritual advice, such as leave your dick alone, which was a bit rich coming from him. "You're going to Australia?" he said. "So you'll be flying over India?" "Yeah, I guess so." "Well, I've got to send you something then." On the day of my departure, a beautifully wrapped package with a peacock feather arrived with the instructions not to be opened until over India. Wow, I thought, spiritual guidance from George Harrison. Some 10 hours into the flight, I looked down and asked the air hostess, "Is that India?" "Yes," she said. "Right," I thought, "time for that spiritual advice." So I reverently opened the package and found inside a small box. I removed a little handwritten card from George. It read, "Shag a Sheila for me." I took his advice. On my return from Oz, my actress friend, Corinthia West, who had been in my Rutland Weekend television series, offered me her basement flat in Pride Street, and then kindly told all her female friends I was gay. One by one, they crept downstairs to convert me. It turned out to be surprisingly easy. We were now setting up for a second season of Rutland Weekend Television, though this time we'd been relegated to Bristol, a 2-hour drive down the M4. It's only very rarely when writing comedy that you actually make yourself laugh. It happened to me just once. I dragged Neil Innes into the RWT project, and his job was to provide 1 or 2 songs per week and send me rough demos of them. I would then fit them into sketches, or link them, or come up with film ideas. One of the songs he sent me for the second season sounded so like the Beatles of the A Hard Day's Night era that it came to me in a flash. We should do it as the Ruttles. At the same time, I came up with a visual gag of a TV interviewer walking and talking to the camera, and the camera begins moving away from him just slightly faster than he's walking, so he has to hurry, then is forced to break into a run to keep up, and finally ends up galloping after the camera, which eventually leaves him behind. This image made me laugh. I just knew it would be funny. Flash forward to later in the year, and we're filming somewhere in Shepherd's Bush, in the mean little back streets behind the BBC. We are set to shoot this gag. I'm wearing a silly wig, as usual, to hide my shoulder-length hair. Our cameraman has done lots of documentaries, and he knows exactly the way the gag should work. The first take works fine. A few days later, we are down in Shepperton Studios filming I Must Be in Love, the song Neil had sent me. Only now, we are dressed as 60s Beatles, and it has become a song from A Hard Day's Rut. It's England, it's freezing, it's intermittently raining, and we're making up sight gags in a field that is now a housing estate. The bit cut together like a dream, and it's one of my favourite pieces from the entire series. In this first iteration, I was playing George. Meanwhile, I had bought a house in St. John's Wood in northwest London to be near my son, and I shared it with my friend Robbie Williams, who worked for Pink Floyd. No, not him. We put a sign on the door that said no luggage to deter young ladies from moving in, a vastly over-optimistic hope, as Australian models flowed through and left their flimsy dresses drying over the Arga. It became quite a party house. In April 1976, we performed Monty Python live for 4 weeks in New York at City Centre, where we were a big hit with fabulous reviews. We were all getting along really well, and the audiences flocked to see us. On the first few nights, we would hang out around the stage door and sign autographs for fans. But after a couple of weeks, the crush grew so great and the police so concerned that we had to jump into a limo and drive out in a hurry. Otherwise, they would follow us to our hotel. It was an instructive lesson in the swiftness and power of fame. Of course, some people did follow us home, and our social lives bloomed. This time, the opening night party was held at Grand Central Station, and we were chased around by Leonard Bernstein, who looked dashing in a cape. We pointed him in Graham's direction. Graham was being particularly naughty. He came to Mike and me and confessed he had slept with a lady. Mike and I said it was all right, we forgave him, but not to make a habit of it. Oddly, we got the news that Monty Python had just become the top-rated TV show in Japan. They'd changed the title. The literal translation was now The Gay Dragon Boys Show. And afterwards, four men in business suits sat on chairs seriously discussing the sketches, including my favourite, the number one deciding guy skit, originally the twit of the year. Spike Milligan said that watching John Cleese dubbed into Japanese was the funniest thing he ever saw. At the Python party, I also met Lorne Michaels, John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase, who were just finishing their first season of Saturday Night Live. Lorne Michaels, a writer on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, had pitched the show to NBC as a cross between Monty Python and 60 Minutes. He even came to London and watched us rehearse and shoot one of our shows, although I don't remember meeting him then. Wisely, NBC bought Saturday Night Live, and it has been running ever since. One night after our show, Terry Gilliam and I went to visit them as they broadcast live from the NBC studios at 30 Rock. Lorne was very friendly, and we stood on the stage floor at 8H, where we were surprised to see they had puppets. John and Dan were very scornful of the puppets and happy that at the end of the season they were leaving for London, where they became The Muppet Show. A few days later, I met Paul Simon in the queue for Bette Midler's dressing room after the opening night of Clams on the Half Shell review. I was a huge fan, and we began chatting as we waited a long time for Elton John to emerge. He was inside giving Bette diamonds. When it was our turn, she graciously showed us round what had been Debbie Reynolds' dressing room. And this is where Debbie pooped, she said, showing us the toilet. Paul would eventually marry Debbie's daughter, Carrie. I took him to see Billy Connolly at Carnegie Hall, where the Manhattan audience struggled to understand Billy's broad Glaswegian accent, while the devoted Scots fans roared their approval of this man in black tights and banana-shaped welly boots. That fall, I would return to New York to host Saturday Night Live for the first time. It was the year of the American Bicentennial. "What's a bicentennial?" asked Ronnie Wood. "It means America is 200 years old," said an American proudly. "Oh, the same age as my house," said Ronnie. Ronnie's house, the Wick, a perfect oval 18th-century home, was a gorgeous Georgian mansion set high on a curve of the Thames near Richmond. I would set off with the delightful Ronnie to the Stones concert at the Earls Court Arena, driving straight backstage in the limo into the encampment where you could eat, dine, play, wash, shower, powder your nose, and generally hang out till showtime. I'd watch the gig and then climb into the limo as everyone went back to Woody's for refreshments and snooker. Several days passed in that haze. I love Ronnie. He'd come and stayed with me in France when he was joining the Stones, and Mick had given him two tapes, one of all the Stones songs to learn, and the second, How to Get Laid in French. What a thoughtful bandmaster. Amongst the many celebrities who flocked to the Python show in New York were Harry Nilsson and Ed Begley, and after I met them on the street, we went for a drink at a bar on 6th Avenue. I liked to drink in those days, but Harry was a professional. Ed told me recently that after we'd had a few, we all went up to Graham's suite at the Navarro Hotel on Central Park South. He innocently knocked at the door and was startled to be greeted by Graham with a full plonking kiss on the mouth. He said he felt honoured. A few nights earlier, George Harrison had come on stage for the Lumberjack song, dressed as a Mountie. He behaved perfectly, stayed in the chorus line, and no one would ever have known it was him. Harry heard about this appearance by George, and there was nothing for it. He was going to come on and be a Mountie too. So they dressed him up, and he entered on cue with the chorus of Mounties. But Harry's performance was a little different from George's. For a start, he was drunk, and he had no intention of remaining anonymously in any chorus line.
He was a star, and he wanted the audience to know it was him on stage. So he wore dark glasses and waved his arms around, leaving the chorus line. He lurched about the stage, gesticulating, swaying dangerously, and generally drawing attention away from the focus of the song, which was, me, as the lumberjack. This caused a certain amount of frosty disapproval from John Cleese, who was less than fond of Graham's alcoholic rock and roll friends, but who had been delightfully enchanted by George and his sweet modesty. When the song ended, there was a feeling of, thank God that's over, as we all stepped back to let the curtain drop. All that is, except for Harry. There was a huge wave of applause and cheers triggered by the end of the song, and Harry wasn't going to miss a minute of this. So as we stepped back, he stepped forward. The curtain fell. "Where's Harry?" we asked, and then laughed as the curtain went back up and he was nowhere to be seen. Ignoring all instructions, he had stepped forward into the dark to acknowledge the cheers and fallen into the orchestra pit. So we all had a good laugh at his expense, and even when it was revealed that he'd broken his wrist, some of the more cynical members of the comedy fraternity expressed less than half-hearted murmurs of sympathy and considered comic karma to have triumphed. Immediately after the run at City Centre, I joined George and Olivia on holiday at the Rockefeller Resort at Keneal Bay on St. John in the Virgin Islands. George had just finished recording 33 and a third, the age we both had now reached, and we played happily on the beach as if we were still seven. It was a fabulous time. One night, we met a couple at dinner.
"What do you do?" said George.
"Import-export," they said.
"Oh," said George. "Have you got any?"
They had. Another afternoon, playing acoustic guitar in his room, we were interrupted by a banging at the door. A young lady was complaining that Norman Lear, the legendary American sitcom creator, was trying to write downstairs, and our music was disturbing him.
"Oh, sorry, love," said George politely. "We'll stop."
A few hours later, a very shamefaced Norman Lear came to the door, utterly embarrassed that he told a Beatle to stop playing guitar. Back in England, George asked me to direct a couple of short promo films for his wonderful new record, though this was well before MTV, when music videos became common. I shot Crackerbox Palace and True Love in the house and gardens of Friar Park. That fall, Lorne Michaels invited me to host the second show of the second season of Saturday Night Live on the 2nd of October 1976, and in my opening monologue I did a very bad version of Here Comes the Sun. I also made a short film with Gary Weiss called Drag Racing, where Dan Aykroyd and I raced in full drag along a tiny landing strip in Flushing, Queens. Lorne asked me to play a clip from my current TV series. I showed him the Ruttles gag and a parody of The Who's Tommy called Pommy, about a deaf, dumb and blind man stuck in a Ken Russell film and his struggle to get out of the cinema. Lorne selected the Ruttles piece. On the live show, the runaway camera gag got a huge laugh, and there was a great audience reaction to the song and the sight of the Ruttles. After the show, there was a surprisingly strong response, many fans writing in, sending letters to the Ruttles and begging for more. I was gratified to hear this because, encouraged by George, I'd been thinking that this could make a very nice documentary. On the phone, I mentioned to Lorne I was thinking of doing this for BBC Two. "Don't do that," he said. "Do it for me through my deal with NBC. You'll have a much bigger budget. If I came to the West Indies for Christmas," he added, "we could talk about it, and he would go back and pitch it to the network as a special." It seemed like a no-brainer. A model was making unmistakable signs of moving in, buying his and her pillows, and showing disquieting signs of nesting. I wasn't ready for a nest. It was time to move on. Lorne's invitation couldn't have been timelier. So it was Barbados for me, tra-la-lee. Fortunately, my life was to change again unexpectedly, and I finally began to grow up. Chapter 11, Love Life. I was 33 before I realized I couldn't shag every woman in the world. Some of them were going to have to remain disappointed. There was no reason to make love to women just because they would let you. I've since learned to love women for being women and not just for what I was trying to do with them. Easy for me to say, now that I'm no longer a danger to shipping.
but most men are completely enslaved by their boss until long after 30. My epiphany began in Barbados, where I woke up one morning on a beach with sandy knees and no knowledge at all of the young lady underneath me. "This has got to stop," I said to myself. "You're no longer even enjoying it. It's just a desperate itch. Pull yourself together and stop all this cereal shagging." And stop it I did. At the same time, I ceased to eat meat. Perhaps they were connected, who knows? On January the 30th, 1977, after a decent interval of abstinence, I met my wife on my first night in New York and fell in love with her at first sight and told her I would never leave her. I never have. Everything about meeting Tanya Kosovich was incurably romantic. Put simply, I was an asshole in my first marriage and bear much responsibility for its early end. I have no regrets since I have a wonderful son, Carey, from it. Men are jerks until quite late in life. I was fortunate to get to that tipping point at 33. I had flown to Barbados to spend Christmas at the Coral Reef Club with Lorne Michaels and Susan Forrestal, Paul Simon and Shelley Duvall. Unfortunately, Shelley was trying to give up smoking and cried a lot. She was so miserable, we begged her to smoke again. Christmas Day was illuminated by an extraordinary performance from a waiter who, slightly inebriated, managed to pour flaming brandy all over himself instead of the Christmas pudding. Luckily, only the brandy burned, but it was a startling effect to be served by a burning waiter. It felt like a Pink Floyd cover. After Christmas, the others left, and I stayed on to await a call from Lorne. I'd met the South African musician Ricky Fattah on the beach outside Heron Bay, and the friendly man who was renting the Palladian villa where Ricky was staying suggested I move in. Ricky and I spent all day on the beach playing guitar and drinking exquisite rum punches served by Mr. Brown. Ricky was falling in love with the beautiful David Bailey model, Penelope Tree, whose father had built, and whose mother now owned, the incredible Coral Stone Villa. We didn't really talk about the strange helicopter pilots who came in at night and met with our host privately. Of course they were in the drug trade, but Ricky and I innocently partied on. I had already changed my diet. No meat was served at Heron Bay, only fish. Now I changed my sexual life. I became a born-again virgin. Finally, after about 6 weeks of paradise, Lorne called and said to come to New York to meet NBC. That was the day that changed my life. I fell in love at first sight. It really happened to me, unexpectedly, surprisingly, and totally. I had flown bronzed and chased from the beaches of Barbados, 86 degrees, to freezing New York, 6 degrees, where Lorne thoughtfully sent a limousine to meet me with an overcoat. I was driven to the Osborne on 57th Street by Carnegie Hall, where Lorne was lending me his apartment, and then on to Rockefeller Plaza for Saturday Night Live with Fran Tarkington as the host. After the show, Paul Simon and Lorne took me to a trendy reception filled with beautiful models. "I'm so over this," I thought smugly. We didn't stay long, and then Paul took us downtown in a white limo to an SNL after-party at Dan Aykroyd's loft in the Bowery. It was a large industrial loft with an old, creaking delivery elevator in the bleakest and grimmest district of the Bowery, on Bond Street, just by CBGB's. Most of our group didn't want to stay long, but I wasn't tired, and I knew Danny and many of the people from the show, so I thought I'd hang out a bit longer. Paul kindly offered to send the limo back for me later. I was standing contentedly by the sink when a tall, beautiful, dark-haired young woman asked me to dance. She said her name was Tanya, and she lived in the loft too. As we danced, I became overwhelmed. I knew I never wanted to leave her side. And not just her side. I kissed her and we necked on the stairs outside her party for 2 hours until finally I said, "I'm never going to leave you." I never have. 41 years ago now, strangely and wonderfully, and at least for a minute, she believed me. I knew then, with the certainty of anything I've ever known, that I must not let this lovely lady get away. Paul's white limo drove us in the early dawn up to the Osborne. Discreet veils were undrawn. As I fell into her arms, I thought, "I'm home." It was January the 30th, 1977. We've been together ever since. A few days later, when I managed to resurface with a smile on my face and the lovely Tanya on my arm, Lorne commissioned me to write a 15-page treatment of the Ruttles story. I bought every picture book I could find of the Beatles, cut them up and pasted them into a rough shape. I then bashed out a treatment in a white-hot fury and sent it in liberally illustrated. To our delight, NBC immediately okayed it. I was commissioned by them to write a full screenplay. I moved into the loft on Bond Street, which Tanya shared with Danny Aykroyd, Mike Payos, a graphic artist for NBC, and an enormous German shepherd called Snark, who scared the bejesus out of me, but happily let me walk him in the terrifying streets of the Bowery at night. It was freezing outside, but the sauna was on day and night, and since it had no door, the heat escaping from it stoked the loft as warm as Barbados. When I queried the expense, they told me a previous tenant had accidentally hooked up the loft's electricity to the budget rent-a-car downstairs, so they never had any electricity bills. Tanya went off to work in the garment district every morning, leaving me happy, warm and in love, writing the Ruttles with Snark for company. I plundered the bookshops for Beatle photographs, read every memoir I could lay my hands on, cut and pasted and wrote, and after a few weeks I finally had a script I felt worked. A big advantage was that George had shown me the long and winding road, an assemblage of Beatle footage that Neil Aspinall, their manager, had put together for Apple to release as a movie. Unfortunately, none of the Fabs could agree on the cut. They all objected to something. The story was indeed a sad one, as it ends up with a lot of bickering on Let It Be when George walked out and John brought Yoko in every day and Paul was clearly unhappy. All You Need Is Cash, my subtitle for the Ruttles story, is essentially a parody of a movie that never got released. I took some great comic inspiration from it, particularly for the Ruttles' manager, Leggy's mum, played brilliantly by Gwen Taylor.
What made the Ruttles so successful?
Well, I think it was the trousers.
The trousers?
Yes, they were very tight.
Tight? Yes, you could see everything, clearly.
Outlines a lot. Oh, I see. The Ruttles story flowed out of me. It was the happiest I'd ever been. Snark kept me company, the sauna kept me comfy, and the lovely Tanya returned at night to feed and delight me. In fact, I married her eventually for her sandwiches. The only slight drawback for a writer was the Carol Conway dance studio directly overhead. The ceiling would bounce all day to the sounds of and one, and two, and three, and four. NBC loved the script, and suddenly we were a go. Gary Weiss was set to co-direct with me, which was great, because we'd already made two short films together for SNL. The first one I wrote was Drag Racing, and the second, Body Language, was one of the funniest things I ever wrote. Lorne had carefully explained to me that, sadly, because I was British, and owing to legal reasons to do with budgets and Writers Guild requirements and the weather and so on, he couldn't actually pay me or credit me for writing them, nor for Frost Nixon, the sketch I wrote and performed with Dan Aykroyd on the eve of the famous interview's broadcast. But I guess he made up for it in dinners. Well, not just dinners. Tanya and I were married in his apartment in NYC. So thanks, Lorne. It was time for me to go back to London and budget the movie. Tanya and I spent a farewell honeymoon in New Orleans, where Lorne had had the crazy idea of shooting Saturday Night Live from the streets of Mardi Gras. It was total chaos, trying to do a TV show from the middle of a mass of drunks, and we could only get anywhere on the back of Harley Davidson police motorcycles. The whole show revolved around Buck Henry and Jane Curtin commentating live on a two-mile-long parade. But sadly, owing to a fatal traffic accident, the parade never appeared during the entire two-hour show, and the broadcast swiftly descended into bedlam. Only Randy Newman and I survived, he because he was on stage, and I because I'd written a piece for myself set in a totally deserted street with just one passed-out drunk, saying, "Only seconds ago, this whole place was jumping, right here, only a few minutes ago," to the sound of the live audience laughing in my earpiece. At our luxury hotel on Bourbon Street, I sadly said goodbye to Tanya as she returned to New York. However,
The minute I landed in London, I couldn't stand being without her, and immediately sent her a ticket, and within 2 weeks she was flying into my arms at Heathrow. From now on, life would no longer be possible without her, and Robbie discreetly moved out, while the no-luggage sign went into the trash. When she first arrived, I drove her around London, pointing out all the wrong places. "That's Buckingham Palace," I would say, pointing to the Houses of Parliament. "Over there is the Post Office Tower," as I pointed to Big Ben. "And that's the Houses of Parliament," as we drove through Trafalgar Square. She was so jet-lagged she's been confused ever since. A budget was approved, NBC said yes, filming dates were set, and I commissioned Neil Innes to compose and record a dozen new Ruttles tracks, which he did brilliantly, as well as play Ron Nasty, his spot-on version of the John Lennon character. He performed this role, singing Cheese and Onions, on Saturday Night Live when I hosted the show again on April the 23rd, 1977. People still think it was really John Lennon. While in New York, I interviewed Paul Simon in his elegant Central Park West apartment about the influence of the Ruttles on his life. He played along beautifully, ad-libbing about the Ruttles' influence and his memories of them at the time. I then interviewed Mick Jagger at his house. "How shall I play it?" asked Mick, somewhat nervously. "Just play Mick Jagger," I said. "Oh, right, okay," he said, and popped straight into character, whereas Mick, he revealed perhaps more than was discreet of his actual memories, a stone's eye view of the Beatles. Confident we had some usable footage in the can, I returned to London, where Neil was back at work recording mock Beatles songs with my friend Ricky Fattar from The Beach in Barbados, whom I now cast as the George character. The producer, Craig Kellam, and I began seeing just how much we could squeeze out of our budget, until, rather reluctantly, I went into hospital for an emergency appendix removal. 10 days later, after a very jolly visit with George Harrison at Friar Park, celebrating my new appendix-free life with champagne and curry, I was rushed back into intensive care, green in the face. Craig Kellam's face was a mask of panic, as I got him to witness my will before the ambulance took me off to the emergency unit at the Wellington Hospital. An unpleasant night or two later, and I was feeling much better. Paul Simon called me as I was recovering, and I told him I was like a big gas balloon waiting to explode. I said, if only I could pass wind, I might begin to come back to life. "Helping people fart is a service I happen to provide," said Paul. And that did it. I started to laugh. I laughed so hard I began to fart. It was loud, long and deep, like a huge balloon emptying. It lasted for almost 2 minutes. It was so loud that Tanya became hysterical. People popped their heads in to see what was wrong. They saw a loudly farting Brit and Tanya in total stitches. When it was over, I thanked Paul profusely. "I've had many thanks in my life, but that's a first for me. Glad to be of use," he said. I had lost a lot of weight in the hospital, but it would prove useful for playing the young Dirk McQuickley. We had a very happy time shooting in London and Liverpool. It was great fun dressing up as the Beatles, being chased around by young fans. Gary and I slipped into a comfortable co-directing relationship. He operated the camera while I stood in front of it, yammering away as the incompetent BBC interviewer. And it all worked remarkably well. I cast Tanya in 4 different roles, a hooker outside the Rat's Keller in the Reaper Barn, the bikini girl lying beside Stanley J. Crammerhead III, the airhead professor from the University of Please Yourself, California, a Ruttles merchandise model, and a fetching gypsy hippie in Love Life. We filmed Ouch on the sand dunes of Southport, where I had played as a kid, faking the West Indies with a cardboard cutout coconut tree. The then Mrs. Jagger, Bianca, came up to play Dirk's wife, Martini, my first screen kiss, and we improvised happily. Ronnie Wood played a Hell's Angel, Roger McGough played Roger McGough, and George Harrison played a TV reporter interviewing Michael Palin playing Derek Taylor. One day, when we were dressed as Beatles standing by the legendary crossing outside Abbey Road Studios, me as Paul and Neil as the full Lennon in beard and white outfit from 10 years earlier, George was talking to us when he was roughly pushed aside by a breathless American tourist who asked Neil and me if we were really the Beatles. He totally ignored the real Beatle. It was a time of fun, magical madness and great music, and all too soon the 5 weeks were over and Gary and I began cutting the movie. I felt it still lacked something. It needed a big performance, so we flew to New York, where I hastily wrote a scene for John Belushi as Ron DeKline, Alan Klein, with Al Franken, future congressman, and Tom Davis as his henchmen. I sketched in a nice scene for the totally adorable Gilda Radner, who would go on to marry Gene Wilder, which we shot in the village, and SNL newcomer Bill Murray improvised wonderfully as Bill Murray the K, a very silly DJ from Flushing. Finally, we shot Dan Aykroyd in the Bowery loft where I'd live with Tanya and written the screenplay. He played the unfortunate record executive who had passed on the Ruttles. "What's it like to be such an asshole?" I asked him. This was the only line NBC cut. We flew to New Orleans, where we were fortunate to find some very talented local actors to film a very bad pun, by the banks of the Mississippi, the First National, the Chase Manhattan, and some interviews about the black roots of Ruttles' music.
"Yes, sir, those four guys from Liverpool came here and stole all my music. He's lying. He's always lying."
I flew out to California to stay with George and Olivia in L.A., showing a rough cut to them and Derek Taylor, who had been the press agent for the Beatles and was now a VP at Warner Brothers Records. Derek was an enormous supporter of the project and encouraged his boss, Mo Austin, to pick up the Ruttles album from Clive Davis at Arista Records. Derek got us a huge artwork budget for the album cover, which became a 10-page pictorial spread that I helped art director Basil Powell assemble in a white-hot fury in 10 days in New York. Michael Palin would co-op Basil for his passepartout on his various travel series, but not before we put together a Life of Brian scrapbook, built out of scraps in an apartment on Hollywood Boulevard, in only 6 weeks, start to finish copy. Derek produced an endless stream of promotional postcards, one with genuine pants material stuck on the back saying, "I think it was the trousers." The first preview was in a crammed cutting room high above Times Square. We invited a small crowd, including our executive producer, Lorne Michaels, and various other friends, who all stared at the tiny screen on the Steenbeck and seemed to have a good time. At the end of the screening, we got them to turn around and look out the window at the huge colour TV screen in Times Square. They turned in amazement to see it lit up with the words, "The Ruttles are coming." Good timing, that, and worth the last of our precious budget. In the end, we decided to do two cuts. The British version ran longer by about 10 minutes and contained the asshole joke, and also included a film, You Need Feet, a parody of Yoko's Bottoms film. NBC scheduled us in prime time opposite the enormously popular Charlie's Angels, so we were absolutely buried in the ratings. But the late-night repeat a few months later fared a lot better. And when the show went to England on BBC Two, it was such a smash hit at Easter that they repeated it on BBC One a month later. People always ask, how did the Beatles react? Well, George was behind it all the way. But the first time I played him Neil Innes' music, he got slightly upset and began to sing "Instant Karma's Gonna Get You" in a very loud voice. It certainly did, since ATV Music grabbed all the copyright to Neil's songs. But after this slight hiccup, George loved the show and was very proud of it. He had supported me throughout, encouraging me to do it, appearing in it, telling me endless Beatles stories and showing me the long and winding road, which eventually became the basis for the 10-part documentary, The Beatles Anthology. Ringo liked the Ruttles after 1968, he added mysteriously. We bumped into Paul and Linda in Regent's Park one foggy morning and smiled and said hello. Then Linda said, "We don't know if we're talking to you." Paul was a little guarded until Linda revealed she really loved it and went on about it. Paul seemed to approve only when he learned that I'd grown up in Wallasey, opposite Liverpool. "Hey, Linda, it's okay. He's a Scouse. He's one of us." I was told John and Yoko loved it, which I thought was very sporting of them, since Yoko is portrayed as Hitler's daughter. But then she has a great sense of humour, as I found out when I made a speech at David Bowie's wedding many years later. I was completely inappropriate at the wedding, which of course went down big with the audience.
When I looked up at the end, Yoko was standing on a table with both thumbs in the air. And, of course, how could she not have a great sense of humour living with John Lennon? The Ruttles was probably the